loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The Syrian army has sent thousands of reinforcements to Aleppo after rebel groups, including the former al-Nusra Front, broke the siege in the eastern part of the city. Is there no end in sight? Turkish President Erdogan has met Vladimir Putin in St. Petersburg on his first trip abroad since last month's attempted coup. What might this mean for the Syria war? Olympics underway, but the struggle against Dilma Rousseff in Brazil reaches a new milestone. But first, we turn to the battle for Aleppo. We are joined from Stuttgart, Germany, by Kevork Almasian. He is a Syrian political analyst. Welcome, Kevork.
Thank you, sir.
You are in Germany. You're from the town of the city of Aleppo, a strategic, what was the biggest city in Syria. Right now, the Syrian army has sent thousands of reinforcements to Aleppo, and rebel groups, including the former al-Nusra Front, broke the siege, apparently, in the eastern part of the city. Talk about the situation right now. How decisive is Aleppo for the outcome of the war?
First of all, since the beginning of the crisis in Syria, the people in Aleppo didn't revolt against the government of Damascus. There were many attempts by the opposition and other regional players in order to push the Aleppese into demonstration and into chaos later on, or to take up arms against the government. However, in the mid-2012, the Turkish intelligence agency succeeded to penetrate some of the eastern parts of Aleppo, thanks to some of the militants coming from the suburbs of Aleppo, not from the city, and also from the governorate of Idlib, which is currently in the hands of Al-Qaeda. Today, this war, which is happening in the last 10 days, is a continuation of the same struggle over Aleppo. There are many regional players and regional powers are keen to make Aleppo on their side. Aleppo is considered the lungs of economic lungs of Syria. It's an industrial city, but also, if we just go back a little bit into history, find that Aleppo was the gate for the Ottomans in order to expand their influence over all the Middle East. So this is a very strategic battle for Turkey, but for also Saudi Arabia. At this moment, the guy who is leading the war on the anti-government militant side is a Saudi cleric. He is the Muhaisini, leading the former al-Nusra Front forces, but also other anti-government forces as well, including the Turkestani forces who came from Western China, the Uyghurs. They are the strongest force now fighting against the government in Aleppo. However, in the last 1 month, there was an attempt by the Syrian government in order to encircle the militants in the eastern side of Aleppo, and they succeeded to impose a siege on these militants. Therefore, the Saudis pushed all their strength in order to break this siege by calling most of their militants from the governorate of Idlib to go and fight to break this siege on Aleppo. Now, if we check the names of the dead militants, we will realize that more than half of the dead militants are coming from Idlib and they are not from Aleppo. There are many multinational fighters with them, including the Uyghurs, as I mentioned, but also Saudis, Egyptians, and other Islamists coming from other countries. On Tuesday, the Syrian army, supported by the Hezbollah forces, but also with the Air Force of Russia, succeeded to close the 1.5-kilometer military road, which the militants succeeded to open up into the eastern sides of Aleppo. This is a very strategic success for the Syrian army because the militants paid a very high price. There are more than 2,000 dead militants, terrorists, in order to open this 1.5-kilometer road to the eastern side of Aleppo. But now, on Tuesday, the Syrian army and its allies succeeded again to close this road, which is the only road for the militants to provide weapons and ammunition and other materials to their fellow terrorist militants in the eastern side, in the eastern neighborhoods of Aleppo.
Kevork Almasian is our guest. He is from Aleppo. He's living right now in Stuttgart, Germany. His family left Aleppo a while ago as a consequence of the war. His parents. Kevork, I want to talk to you a little bit about what you've described. You've described Aleppo and perhaps other parts of the Syrian conflict as essentially a proxy war. You talked about Aleppo not having risen up originally in 2011 against the government of Bashar al-Assad. Of course, in the Western media, it's presented as a struggle for freedom or a struggle between ethnic groupings, a struggle by the Sunni majority against the Alawite government or predominantly Alawite government in Damascus. Right now, we have a meeting that took place yesterday between President Erdogan of Turkey and Vladimir Putin. Obviously, in different sides of the Syrian conflict, you have the Russians coming in on the side of the Damascus government, saying that this Syrian government, whoever its leader might be, is an indispensable part to the resolution. You have Erdogan having funneled money and fighters into the conflict, and as you said, became decisive in the battle for Aleppo. Can you see a change taking place in terms of Turkey's orientation towards Aleppo and towards the Syrian conflict? And if so, would that be decisive in the battle for Aleppo?
We can say that around a couple of weeks ago, there was a change in the rhetoric of the Turkish government, especially by the new prime minister of Turkey, saying that they have to revive the Turkey's relationship with the neighbors, because the zero problems with the neighbors turned to be into zero relationship with the neighbors, and that they need the neighbors. At the end of the day, they are not living in an island. And Syria is one of the important neighbors, because most of the trades coming from Europe, but also the Turkish products, they can't reach to the Gulf market without Syria. That's why they were trying the sea road to Haifa port and from Haifa to Jordan, from Jordan to Gulf. But it's costing a lot of money for the Turks, but also for the Europeans. Now, after the failed coup attempt against Erdogan, it seems that Erdogan will try to balance rebalance its policy again. This is only a speculation. We don't know yet. But this is his new rhetoric that he will open up again to Russia and saying that Russia is an important partner in solving the problems of the Middle East. This is a positive signal, but still not translated on the ground. Today's offensive on Aleppo by 7,000 to 8,000 militants was not possible without the support of Turkey. So after this meeting, we have to check the realities on the ground and how these militants will receive their reinforcements, because most of the reinforcements were coming from northern borders with Turkey, but also from Idlib city. So when we say that most of the fighters and their weapons were coming from Idlib, that means it's coming from Turkey. It's on the borders with Turkey. So we have to check in the next few days, maybe in the next few weeks, how Erdogan will deal with the phenomena of terrorism in Syria. He used to consider the Kurds as terrorists, but ISIS as a partner before the reconciliation with Russia. But maybe now it's time for Erdogan to make a U-turn in his policies, because the biggest loser from the war in Syria might be Erdogan. If the Syrian army succeeded to retake Aleppo again, all his neo-Ottoman dreams will fade away. This is one. The second, the Russian support to the YPG and other Kurdish forces in the northern part of Syria created some sort of buffer zone between Turkey and the Syrian government forces by these Kurdish elements. And for Turkey, this is a red line, and it is a strategic danger for the Kurds that there might be an independent military and political entity governed by the Kurds on the northern side of Syria. So for both Damascus government and for the Ankara government, this is considered a red line. Therefore, I might speculate, this is only an analysis at the moment. This might be translated on the ground or not, we don't know. But there is a mutual ground now between Syria and Turkey, both governments, which is the Kurds. The growing independence of the Kurds, both on the military and the political level, is a danger for both sides. So this mutual ground might soften the tensions between the both sides, and there might be indirect messages in order to sandwich the Kurds again and foil the project of creating an independent state or federal state in the northern part of Syria, which will lead later on into division of the Syrian Arab Republic.
Okay, let me ask you about the rebranding that's taken place by the al-Nusra Front. It rebranded itself a few weeks ago as Fatah al-Sam, disassociating itself from the al-Qaeda. What's been their relationship to the other rebel forces, not just in Aleppo, but around the country? And is it difficult to differentiate between them and the groups called moderate rebels by Western powers?
Actually, the rebranding of Al-Nusra Front started almost 1 year ago, and Qatar was the main player who encouraged this rebrand, because Qatar is one of the main supporters of Al-Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham in Syria. This pressure came from Qatar, but also from the United States, because most of the programs, the American programs to arm and support the so-called moderate rebels, proven to be failed programs. The Americans are not able to find so-called moderate rebels in Syria. The vast majority of them are Islamists, regardless of their brands or names or flags, whether it's Free Syrian Army or Ahrar al-Sham or Islam's Army or ISIS or al-Nusra Front. All of them believe in political Islam. The only difference is the philosophy. Some of them say we want a caliphate, the others say we want an Islamic State, but all of them share the same thing, that they want to impose the Sharia laws in Syria. This rebranding was important for the United States in order to have a new military wing in Syria. For them, most of the projects of arming the moderate rebels failed, so by rebranding al-Nusra Front, they might promote this group as a moderate rebel group. However, we all know that the ideology of this group is the same as Al-Qaeda. If we change its name to anything we want, you know, any names, it's not important. The names are not important. What's important is their behavior on the ground is genocidal against everyone who disagrees with this tsunami of Salafism, which hit Syria, including the Sunnis themselves, who are a very big victims of this so-called revolution in Syria. If we check the numbers, the statistics, and the dead Syrian soldiers, we will see that most of them are not even Alawis, as the mainstream media claims. The vast majority of the Syrian army is from the Sunni sect, not from the Alawi sect, as they claim. And even the Syrian government, the head of the Syria, President Bashar Assad, might be Alawi, but the foreign minister, defense minister, interior minister, the 70% of the government are Sunnis. So at the moment, I believe Americans need boots on the ground, and the rebranding Jabhat al-Nusra might be one of the choices for them in order to fight ISIS on one hand and the Syrian government on the second hand. Until this moment, the Americans didn't agree. They don't have any kind of major agreement of a vision for Syria with the Russians. The conflict is still there. The Russians didn't come into consensus with the Americans about the future of Syria. So in my opinion, this war will still go on even after the elections in the United States, and it depends on the result of these elections. If Hillary Clinton comes to power, the war in Syria will intensify. There will be more support to Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and this means that Saudi Arabia and Qatar will send more weapons to these terrorist groups in Syria. But if Donald Trump comes to power, despite his racist rhetoric inside the United States, but on the foreign policy level, he is ready to cooperate with other partners on international and regional level in order to crush ISIS first and to solve the Syrian conflict too.
Yes, I think it's very, very unlikely. This is, of course, a personal opinion, that Donald Trump will be the president of the United States. Most of the Republican Party establishment, as well as the Democratic Party establishment, opposes Trump. Wall Street opposes Trump. The military-industrial complex opposes Trump.
I totally agree with you.
I think Hillary Clinton will be the elected president. And recently, there's been a letter in the U.S. State Department, 51 disgruntled members of the State Department, the Foreign Service officers, sent a letter criticizing the Obama administration, an internal letter, for not doing enough in Syria, meaning not expanding in a military way, escalating the U.S. military involvement against the Assad government. So if Clinton is the president of the United States, you expect that the war will widen. Now, do you see, and we have about a minute left, do you see any possible way that there could be a military resolution of the conflict in the next few months, especially if, for instance, the Turkish political establishment changed its own orientation towards the border?
I think realistically speaking, I don't see there is a military way out within a few months. Even if the Turks and the Saudis and all the parties halt their direct support to these terrorists in Syria, the operations might take 1 to 2 years to crush the militants in Syria. We are speaking about more than 100,000 anti-government forces in Syria. They are not 1,000 or 2,000, and they are distributed in most of the cities, you know, and the strongest party is ISIS, and until this moment, the war in Raqqa didn't even start. So how could we possibly end this Islamist terrorism in Syria while ISIS is still there with its full forces in Raqqa, and there are thousands of militants from different countries are still fighting in Aleppo and Idlib. I don't see there is a military way out before the elections in Washington. And if Hillary Clinton comes to power, that means we have 4 more years of war in Syria. Just check how the sources are supporting Hillary Clinton. They are even financing her campaign. For them, Hillary Clinton might be their last hope to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad, because for Saudi Arabia, the matter of Syria became a personal issue.
Kaborg, we're gonna have to leave it there. We're completely out of time. We've been joined by Kaborg Almasian. He's talking to us from Germany. He is from Aleppo, Syria. We're talking about the war in Syria. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Turkish President Erdogan has met with Vladimir Putin in St. Petersburg on his first trip abroad since last month's attempted coup. Is it back to business as usual between Turkey and Russia? We are joined from Moscow by Peter Lavelle. He is the host of RT's flagship talk show, Crosstalk. Welcome back, Peter.
It's always good to be with you, Brian.
At the press conference held after the meeting, President Putin declared his intention to, quote, restore our relations to the pre-crisis level. President Erdogan was similarly warm, saying, quote, the visit strikes me as a new milestone in our bilateral relations, starting again from a clean slate. Is it really possible for there to be a true reset in Turkish-Russian relations? Is that what we're witnessing?
Well, I mean, a total reset to what we had before the downing of the Russian jet in November. Well, that's okay, but the relations between the two countries weren't particularly great. My major takeaway from all of this is that Erdogan knows that he has a number of options in front of him, because he is willing, he's shown a willingness to reset relations with a number of countries and maybe to look differently at the West. And I think, you know, considering the attempted coup and all of the murkiness associated with that, one thing is crystal clear, is that the military made it very obvious to Erdogan is Turkey doesn't need to have bad relations with Russia. That just isn't going to work, because Turkey would find itself isolated, as it did because of the Syrian crisis. So Erdogan is taking virtue from necessity here, and the Russians are more than happy to reach out a hand here. So it's both countries are looking at their national interests. And we can look at Erdogan and we can look at Putin, but Russia and Turkey have an opportunity right now to maybe explore some areas that they hadn't thought about before, because of Turkey's membership with NATO, because of the domestic situation inside of Turkey, and of course, the ubiquitous conflict going on in Syria. Everything is possible right now, and I think that's what both of these leaders are saying to their own domestic audiences and looking at each other across the table. It's a very interesting time now, but I don't think we should be rash in drawing any conclusions.
Right, I hear you. After the July 15th coup, the Turkish media was really inculcating the public in Turkey with the idea that the United States, the U.S. military in particular, was behind the coup. There was an ambiguity in the way U.S. policymakers and the U.S. media treated the coup until it became clear that the coup was going to fail, at which time they announced their support for Erdogan. But it wasn't while the coup was actually taking place in its first hours. There's some speculation that if Erdogan goes to Russia as he has, if there's a restoration of relations, if there's an attempt to find some sort of diplomatic or resolution on the issue of Syria, which of course has been a major point of contention, that Turkey might in fact start to move away from NATO or move away from its historic cooperation with EU, which of course it's not a member of the EU, and towards Russia or towards the Eurasian project. Do you think that's premature, that kind of speculation?
Well, I think what's most important here, even though I personally have very strong views and worried thoughts about what's happening domestically in Turkey, we have to remember And I have to remember how nation states actually function. I think that the Western propaganda about statecraft is confuses a lot of people. Turkey is a mid-sized power in the geopolitical scheme of things. In the region, it is a great power in the Middle East here. What I think Turkey is going to do, as any rational power of its status, it's going to play off different players to get what it wants most. And that's perfectly natural. The Russians are perfectly aware of that. Turkey is not going to leave NATO anytime soon. But will it use its membership to leverage certain things that it wants vis-a-vis the region? Of course it's going to do that. You should expect it to do that. We shouldn't be naive about that. I don't see any black and white. They're going to turn their back completely on NATO and the European Union and fall into some kind of eastern orbit with Russia, China, Iran. That could happen at one point, but I don't see it happening now. And why should we expect it to happen? Erdogan is a survivor. Look at his political career. He knows how to look at different mixes and use it to his advantage. So I think that's what we should be expecting. What's he going to leverage most to get what he wants? And what we have to do is figure out what he wants, and then we can figure out how he'll probably leverage it.
Yes, I hear you, and I in fact agree with you. I think Erdogan and Turkey as the eastern flank of NATO is there to stay, at least for a considerable time. But there has been a shift in U.S. policy towards Turkey. 2 years ago, when Erdogan came to Washington, he was treated, well, he was given the royal treatment. He met with Obama, big deal. And then the last time he came, he was snubbed. He met with Obama just on the sidelines. There was a clear change in orientation. Before the July 15th coup attempt, it was clear also that Erdogan had made a decision to reorient Turkey, normalized its relations with Israel. It started to normalize its relations with Russia, apologized, so to speak, for the downing of the Russian aircraft. And at the same time, it announced that it was willing to normalize relations with Syria, but then threw in the caveat that, of course, to have a true normalization, the Assad government must go. Do you see any possibility of a dramatic shift in Turkey's orientation towards the war in Syria?
I think that that is in the cards, because you mentioned Erdogan's visits to the United States. Well, the Turks are furious with the United States and its allies because of the Kurd issue, because that was Turkey's red line. And the Americans very callously, in a very cavalier way, dismiss these concerns. So these are, irrespective of how you feel about the Kurdish issue, this is a national security issue for Turkey. And I think that's where a lot of the cold shoulder is coming. I mean, when you see on videos where American troops trade their emblems with the Kurds, actually they were female soldiers, and that's shown all over Turkish television, that's just, it's insulting. And I think that Erdogan is reminding the Americans that they are a member of NATO, and they want Turkey to remain an important member, a valued member, they need to wake up and listen to their concerns. This, you know, the Obama administration has completely dropped the ball on that. Now, to answer your question about Syria, this is a catastrophe for Turkey, because aiding and abetting these terrorist groups, allowing them to use the porous border into Syria, is a catastrophe for Erdogan and Turkish society. So I see that there's going to be a lot more, possibly a lot more regulation of that border here. And that's where the Russians and the Turks can actually work together. I think both of them want to see this conflict come to an end. As far as the red line, Assad must go, I think that from the Turkish side, there's going to, I mean, if they can have a rapprochement with Russia and rapprochement with Israel, I think that they can reassess the Syrian situation as well. The costs are just way too high for Turkey, because as we both know, Erdogan has a lot on his plate at home. And when you add into the mix terrorists that you used to support, and now they're coming across the border and spreading their mischief in your own country, Erdogan has to wake up and realize that's not working out. And the country that has had the worst foreign policy in the entire region vis-a-vis Syria has been Turkey. And so for self-survival and for his domestic agenda, which is very, very complicated, and it's going to be a long stretch for him, because I see that he wants to completely reorganize Turkish society, he's going to be looking a lot more inward right now. And I think, again, go back to our main topic here, having good relations with Russia is part of that process.
Right. Erdogan is trying systematically and has been doing so since the coup with even more determination and on a vaster scale to carry out a purge, not just in the military, but in all sectors of Turkish society, and also waging what amounts to a war against the secular institutions that were the hallmark of Turkey since the revolution, the Ataturk Revolution, following World War I. But let's go back, Peter Lavelle, to Syria. There's a huge battle and perhaps a decisive battle going on in Aleppo. And the question really will be whether the opposition, the terrorist forces inside of Aleppo, can be able to break the siege and allow thousands, perhaps, of new fighters to cross into their area in eastern Aleppo. Would Erdogan, under the current circumstances of the attempted rapprochement with Russia, and of course Russia's there supporting the Syrian Arab Army and the Assad government, close the border between Turkey and Syria, which it could do, or it could do greatly, that would really stop the flow of fighters and funds and weapons that have been the lifeblood for the terrorist organizations? Will it do that?
I think really the key is all of this is, and we don't know, and this is what we need to find out most, because most of what was said at the media briefing, we could have easily guessed, you know, gas deals, nuclear power deal, defense deals. We could have all expected those things here. But what I would really like to know is, what did Putin and Erdogan say about the Kurds? Because if the Russians can sweeten the pot and move towards the direction of how the Turks feel about the Kurdish issue in northern Syria, that's the deal clincher right there. I don't see that Erdogan has any more gut for this war in Syria. What has he gotten out of it? Nothing. He's gotten absolutely nothing out of it. And he knows, in looking at American policy towards Syria, that he's the guy left outside. He's the odd man out. What did he get from his alliance membership? Zip. And so if Putin and Erdogan came to some kind of understanding and how to deal with the Kurdish issue, I think and connecting the dots, it makes a lot of sense. Erdogan might really just want to sew up this war and let it go, because like we both agree, he's got a lot on his plate at home. He has to wonder if there's any hope for a European Union membership, which I think has never been a realistic hope. And now he has to decide how he needs to reorient his society. And Syria is just a drain on him. There is no way the Russians will allow the Damascus regime to fail. And he's got to understand that now. And so what's the point in continuing it? He has allies in the region that he can't trust. The Americans have not supported him in the Kurdish issue. I think that, you know, if Putin made a good pitch and it seemed reasonable, I think it's realistic, he might take it.
Well, let's talk about what that good pitch might look like, because, of course, the Kurds, the YPG, the People's Protection Units, that are the Turks consider them to be like the Syrian branding or the Syrian version of the PKK, the Workers' Party of Kurdistan, that the Turkish government's at war with at this moment. The Russians up until now have said the YPG, the Kurds who are in the northern part of Syria, who are really fighting for an autonomy within a larger federated Syria, that they should be involved in the peace negotiations, the ceasefire negotiations, the negotiations that could lead to a political resolution ending the war. Of course, they have not been allowed to be part of those negotiations, probably because the United States up until now, even though it's using the insignia of the YPG on U.S. military uniforms, has been, you know, sort of bowing to Erdogan's desires to exclude the Kurds. But what would a Russian shift on the Kurds mean, or would this require an Erdogan shift on the Kurds? Because right now the Kurds are excluded. The issue is, will they be included in a political resolution?
Well, I think, you know, we always have to be very careful in what kind of sway the Russians have with the Syrian government. I think it's a lot less than a lot of people think. But we do know that it's critical in certain areas, air power and supply of military material. I mean, it seems to me is what the Russians can say to Assad. And this is, again, why I think that Erdogan, he will be open to dealing with the Assad government, because if the Russians put a lot of pressure on Assad how to deal with the Kurds, and Erdogan can come to terms with how Syria would create some kind of limited autonomy. I mean, essentially what Erdogan wants to avoid now, he can't do much about the Kurds in Syria and he can't do much about the Kurds in Iraq. What he has to worry about is the Kurds in Turkey. Now, if that can be a part of the mix there, then I think he can take a step back here. What he has to look at is, number one, domestic policy and how to deal with the Kurds there, which has been a disaster. He needs to reorient there. But if he can close the border and essentially make a viable Kurdish state, which we both know, the longer this war goes on, the greater the possibility of a Kurdish state. Now, you wind this war up, well, the biggest losers outside of the people that have lost their lives are going to be the Kurds. The Kurds have been cursed in history. The possibility of them getting a state has almost always been zero. But during this conflict, has given some people hope. The Russians, the Syrians, and the Turks, if they get together, they can resolve that issue. Of course, it'll be at the expense of the Kurds. That's the nature of geopolitics.
But in other words, can you see, just to clarify what you're saying, Peter, because I think it could be perhaps the linchpin here, are you saying that you could see the Erdogan government agreeing to some sort of limited autonomy within northern Syria for the Kurds as long as the border was sealed?
You know, that's something that Assad is going to have to talk with the Russians first, because the one thing our listeners have to understand is that the U.S. and its allies have done so very little, pitifully little, to end this conflict. As a matter of fact, they've been fueling it. Over 3,000 tons of munitions have been shipped there since the ceasefire on February 27th. That's pretty extraordinary here. But if you can get the players that are on the ground, if they can make this kind of move, then they're going to force the hands of other people. If we can get regional players that are on the ground there them to make these hard decisions, because the U.S. has no interest in this happening. We still hear the same words, Assad must go. So, I mean, Erdogan has seen that he's never gotten any favors from Washington over this entire conflict. The Russians have made it very clear that they will be there under certain circumstances. What Washington wants to have happen is to turn this into Putin's quagmire. And Russia has been very, very nimble in making sure that it doesn't get pulled into this. And so that's what the Russians are going to say to Assad. Listen, Assad, we've done a lot for you. We're going to make sure Syria remains a sovereign state. We're going to help you eliminate terrorism here. But you have a complicated demographic. Now, I'm pretty sure, considering everything that's happened, Assad would agree to some kind of limited autonomy, as long as you don't call it Kurdish. Okay? It's like the Macedonian issue. You know, it's a name. It resonates with certain people. You can't use certain names. You know, the Federation of Syrian States of the North or something like that there, which if you give the autonomy, maybe that's just enough, considering what has happened during all of this conflict, and close that border. And that's what the crux of it is here is for the Russians. It's really about the border. And if you can close the border, well, then we have a radiant future ahead of us. But if that border remains porous, then, you know, the Russians are going to have to say, we've done our bit, but you have to do yours. And considering, again, the domestic agenda that Erdogan has in front of him, closing that border may be the biggest favor he can do for himself.
Indeed. Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been joined from Moscow by Peter Lavelle. He's the host of RT's flagship show, Crosstalk. Thanks again, Peter, for joining us. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Protesters for and against Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff rallied outside of the Senate on Tuesday as lawmakers voted on moving her to within steps of losing office as part of the impeachment process. But do her opponents have the two-thirds needed in the Senate to oust her? We are joined by Alina Cepiva of Brazilian Expats for Democracy. She's here in studio in Washington, D.C. And from London by Brazilian-British analyst Victor Fraga. Welcome back, Alina and Victor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan.
Victor, let's start with you. The Brazil Senate has been debating whether to move ahead with the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, but we've been seeing protests against interim president Michel Temer at the Olympics since it started on Friday. What's the mood in Brazil right now, and what do you expect in the Senate?
People are outraged. People are furious. People want interim, deeply reactionary and illegitimate president Michel Temer out. However, politicians, including the Senate, and most importantly, the Supreme Tribunal, have implemented a juristocracy in Brazil whereby they disregard the wish of the people and act according to their own interests. The interim president has a rejection of about 80%, and the media has been doing their utmost to disguise that, to lift the mood of the country. Jingoism has all of a sudden embraced the country, and the reactionaries want to benefit from the jingoism involved and the patriotism involved in the Olympics in order to lift the mood, disregarding the fact that the Olympics were brought to Brazil by Lula, and the fact that the opening ceremony and the organization has been a success boils down to pretty much to Dilma's administration. So to add insult to injury, they've been trying to silence people in the stadia. They've been trying to prevent them from protesting, from holding very simple signs that say Temer out, and in an affront to freedom of speech and democracy, and tearing the Brazilian constitution to pieces.
Okay, let's bring Alina Sepeva in. She is here in the studio in Washington, D.C. She's part of the Brazilian Expats for Democracy, a group that's been organizing people and mobilizing people in the Washington, D.C. area against the coup. Alina, let me just ask you, we saw in the capital, Brasilia, fences had been erected to keep rival rallies apart. How polarized has Dilma's impeachment made the country? Were those divisions already present? And what do you expect to come in the coming days? Does the right wing, does Temer's government, the acting president, have enough votes in the Senate to keep the suspension process going?
Yes, there is a lot of moods going on in Brazil. People are angry. People want a resolution for what's happening in Brazil right now. But I don't think it's accurate to say what's going on is a polarization. What you are seeing now in Brazil is that for the first time in our history, people who never had voice, who never spoke out about what they were feeling, what they thought about in politics, in what happened in Brazil, they are now taking the streets and they are showing their discontent. I think it is important for us to notice that the Brazilian media plays a huge role in trying to bring this idea that Brazil, that once was like this ideal country of harmonic society, is now polarized. And that is not that's not something that happens only in Brazil. It is happening in Venezuela. It's happening in Argentina. So this is one of the faces that the media takes to undermine the progressive governments in Latin America and try to put our achievements from the past decade and half in a second place.
Very interesting. Yes, of course, it's throughout Latin America, in Argentina, in Venezuela, all over, there is a struggle between those who have been fighting for a progressive social program and in many cases, the elites who control some of the private-owned media, and of course, with the backing of the United States and commercial and business elites in those countries trying to stop that momentum that we've seen for the past two decades. Victor Fraga, I want to talk about the outcome here. You had Dilma Rousseff suspended because of the impeachment process, but since then, she's been going around the country. She's been rallying people, as Alina said. People who may never have had a voice before in politics are finding their voice. They're coming into politics. Is it possible that this coup attempt, this legislative coup, it's not like the 1964 coup, but a legislative coup, could be the thing that would provoke a backlash such that the forces of the right wing could be ultimately sent back?
Well, I believe in the power of the people. The power of the people are finally making themselves heard. As Alina pointed out, the media has been trying to paint the country as polarized. The country is not polarized. The country has finally opened their eyes, and they saw that this coup, Hugo impeachment, is not an attempt to remove corruption. Quite the opposite. It's an attempt to legitimize corruption. And they are now, 80% of Brazilian people want this gang of criminals that is currently running the country out. However, the Supreme Court has traded a rise of a pay rise of 41% in exchange for their silence and their complacency with the coup. So this 41% increase in their pay has made them one of the best paid judicial systems in the world. This pay rise alone equals nearly 30 billion reais, which is roughly the same as the Bolsa Família, the major social program in Brazil. So what I'm saying is they're corrupt, they've been bought, they don't care about the people. These reactionaries function on the basis of money. But I do think that people will make themselves heard, and I think there's a chance that the voice of the people will change what's happening. I'm personally in favor of taking arms. I think that what's happening in Brazil is beyond unacceptable. What's happening in Brazil is urgent. It's much worse than what's happening in, say, Argentina or Venezuela. Because it's not simply a dispute between left and right. The right in Brazil has proven that it's intrinsically corrupt and that it will do anything to seize power. This is a coup. This is a coup d'etat. We're trying to implement a dictatorship. They're now trying to... one judge in the Supreme Court has proposed to outlaw PT, the Workers' Party. They're trying to silence people in the stadia. A parliament passed a law last week allowing ISPs and local authorities to snoop on people's internet. So we are seeing, and I wouldn't even say slowly, very fast democracy collapse and a dictatorship being implemented in Brazil. So people need to act. And if that includes taking arms, I'm personally in favor of that.
Okay, Alina Piva, I want to put, for the audience sake, sort of put this into a larger perspective, because people who may not be paying attention or careful attention to Brazil might not get the full sort of dimension or magnitude of what's going on. The Workers' Party government, led in this time by Dilma Rousseff, has won four consecutive elections. Perhaps the right wing didn't think they would win the last election in 2014 because of the economic crisis. The crisis caused not by Brazil, but by the meltdown of Wall Street bankers that rippled through the world. It created a lot of problems, a lot of economic and social problems. The incumbent parties around the world might be held responsible for that. The right wing was surprised. The Dilma and the PT, the Workers' Party, won again. So they used these extrajudicial means to impeach the government and then try to sideline it and sort of retake power. That's what we mean by a coup. And of course, they had the silent, at least, and sometimes vociferous support of elements within the Washington establishment. But now we see the tide is turning. Not only, as Victor said, do 80% of Brazilians disapprove of the new coup regime, but there are voices in the United States that are saying this is an illegitimate coup. There was some politicians in the United States are beginning to speak out. Bernie Sanders did. 40 members of Congress wrote a letter. This is not a legal trial, but a political one, meaning the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, where a 2/3 majority vote by Senate riddled with corruption can end President Rousseff's tenure. You're getting international support even from unlikely sources right now. Talk about that.
Yes, people... It's getting harder and harder for this Temer government to maintain this aura of legitimacy of that what is going on in Brazil is at somehow something within the constitution, the constitutional means. It is getting harder and harder because evidencing is mounting that there is no accusation that Dilma Rousseff did not commit any crime. But yet, it has been really hard to overcome this blackout of the traditional media, not only in Brazil, but also here in the United States and elsewhere in the world. So when people like Bernie Sanders and the congressmen here in the U.S., when they speak out against what is going on in Brazil, they help to breach this blackout and spread the word that what is happening in Brazil is illegal. It is a coup and it is against the Brazilian people.
Victor Fraga, the New York Times called Temer's party, the PMDB, the party, this is a quote, the party that ruined Rio, close quote. What effect did their policies have on the city?
I wouldn't say it had a major effect as such. But PMDB have been not just running the country since the coup, but they Eduardo Paes runs Rio de Janeiro. And Rio is as violent as ever. There's the notorious case of a cycling path on the sea, which collapsed and the cyclist died just a few months, 2 or 3 months after it was inaugurated. So their incompetence, PMDB's incompetence to run Rio, is paramount to their incompetence and deep corruption and lack of ethics in running the country. So the opening of the Olympics were a show of justice. There was a message of justice. There was a green message of environment. But remember, all of that was created by Daniela Thomas, who was initially hired by the British Brazilian government. The message had this dictatorship been installed a few years back, certainly the message of the Olympics wouldn't be a message show of inclusion. There would be some veiled elements of multiculturalism because they still need to sell Brazil abroad. But the beautiful side of the Olympics is certainly and solely due to Dilma's and Lula's administration. The Olympics have not been a complete failure because they put a very beautiful act, and it was a failure in the sense that very few international head of state, I think only 18 international head of states attended the opening of the Olympics, mostly in protest against our current dictator. In Brazil, there's even a joke. It was such a failure that not even the Brazilian president attended, in reference to the fact that Dilma wasn't there and that Temer, who was booed, the media tried to mute, to silence the boo, but that didn't work. I mean, we're getting unlikely supporters, as Aline mentioned. Members of parliament in the U.S., the U.S. is complacent with the coup. There's several suggestions of that. The main judge, Sergio Moro, there's evidence of the car wash investigations, which are one-sided investigation aimed solely at destroying the Workers' Party. There's evidence that he was trained by the CIA years ago. One of the biggest coup plotters, Aloysio Nunes, the day following the voting, the most important vote for the coup in the lower house of parliament in April, he flew the next day to meet Thomas Shannon in Washington, who is the most senior person in Latin American affairs in the American government. And the list goes on and 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 on. The involvement of the U.S. is enormous. So, despite this, you got voices like Bernie Sanders and congressmen standing against that. If you're getting that, that's a very, very strong sign that things going extremely wrong. What's happening in Brazil is absolutely nothing short of a disaster. Brazil wanted to implement a new international fund with the BRICS. Brazil has oil. So the purpose of this coup is much broader than democracy in Brazil. It's about changing the international order. It's undermining BRICS, undermining the force of the new fund.
Okay, Victor, let me bring in, we're winding down in terms of time. Let me bring Aline back in. Victor is right. The AFL-CIO, the United Steelworkers, the American Federation of Teachers, the United Auto Workers, the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, Congressman John Conyers, Marcy Kupter, Keith Ellison, these are all congresspeople, John Lewis, Barbara Lee, James McGovern, they all signed that letter. It's really something, given the fact that the United States government has been a principal supporter of the coup of the Temer government, that there is starting to be, in addition to Bernie Sanders, all these unions and progressive congresspeople who are now taking a stand. Let me ask you, Aline, in the last 2 minutes, we have former President Lula, the founder of the Workers' Party, the one who brought the Olympics to Brazil. He could be facing criminal charges, which could have the impact of sidelining him in the 2018 election, an election that he will otherwise win. Talk about Lula's case right now and how important it is in terms of the outcome here.
This is a really important point. When we are analyzing what is happening right now in Brazil, we cannot forget that it is not only an impeachment against Dilma Rousseff. It is a process against the project for the country that was being implemented by the Workers' Party. And furthermore, this is a process against Lula. It is trying to destroy not only his legacy, but he as a person and his family and to do that, Judge Sérgio Moro, as Victor said, will go will do whatever it takes to achieve that. So a couple of weeks ago, one judge from Brasilia, he pressed charges against Lula, and what he says is that Lula participating in an attempt to prevent Nestor Severo, who is the former president of Petrobras, to depose in the Lava Jato investigation. But there is no proof against him. It's just a scheme to try to undermine his chances in 2018.
The impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, who's not corrupt on corruption charges, and the attempt to indict and take to trial Lula, the most popular leader in Brazil, the founder of the Workers' Party, on trumped up charges, also designed by the right wing to obstruct real democracy. That's all the time we've had. We've been joined by Alina Sipiva of the Brazilian Expats for Democracy here in Washington, D.C., and from London by Brazilian-British analyst Victor Fraga. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.